Thank Brian and the reading, and David, you led singing twice today. That means something went wrong. I don't know what it was exactly, but somewhere David stepped in either this morning or tonight and did a very fine job. We should appreciate it. And Jared's prayer as well. You know, it's been a humbling thing over the last year and a half or more, the number of times that I've been prayed for. The elders always get mentioned here in very kind and loving ways, and that's greatly appreciated. I also appreciate some extra words about preaching and letting things go well. It's always kind to hear those things. And as we think about it tonight, our topic is that of house churches. As you'll notice later on in the lesson, when we talk a little bit about some of the things that characterize what might be called a house church movement, something a little bit different than just simply meeting in a house. This idea of individuals leading us and helping us in some way through a reading, through the prayer, through the song service, is a very important role and one that we need to think about a little bit as we go on later in the discussion. But it's good to think about what was done for us so far. We appreciate what they did. Last week we started to look at this. I think by now probably most of you know that what the topic tonight is. You either heard it announced this morning or I just said it, and you probably caught a little bit of what I meant by that. A lot of you were here last week. Perhaps some of you missed it as well. I'll tell you, I'm a little puzzled as to whether or not this topic deserves two lessons. I did it in part because of Joel Dombowski, who wanted a sermon on it and wasn't here last week, so I needed to stretch it out for Joel's purposes. But really, I think that there are things said by those who feel like that they need to dramatically change the manner in which they worship. They need to do something that's very different than perhaps the way that they had worshipped in past with churches such as this church. That in their anxiety and in their feeling of needing to do something very different, they've raised questions that are important to all of us. The questions that I think cut to the very heart of why we are a church like this church. Why do we worship in the manner that we worship? Why do we attempt to open up God's Word the way that we do? And because of that, I think that it's worth having a number of lessons about that topic. And perhaps what we're really doing are doing some things that go beyond this idea of a house church movement. However, there are those that have established churches in houses with a very intent purpose of changing things. And they've been critical of the way that things are often done in churches such as this. We mentioned, for example, a book by LaGard Smith this past Sunday, called Radical Restoration. Restoration is a good thing. And if we need to radically change in order to restore things the way they were in the New Testament, I think that we should do that. But in this book, there's a lot of criticism made about the way that perhaps even we do things here, worth our attention. I also mentioned to you that Paul Earnhardt preached three lessons on this topic, so you're getting by pretty light just to have two. I mean, I've cut out an entire lesson. But some of you have mentioned to me you have family or others that you know that are caught up in things such as we talked about last week, would like to know more about it. I'll try to help you any way I can to get Paul's lessons. They're much better than what you're hearing, much more organized. A lot of the structure that I got, I really got from Paul. But here we have this idea then of house churches. And at first, someone said later after the lesson last week, you know, for a while I wasn't really sure whether you were for that or against it. You had me a little worried for a period of time. And someone else pointed out, rightfully so, that the lesson was a little bit hard to follow at times because you had a lot of positive things to say about those in this movement, and you had some very critical things to say as well. And that's true. And it won't get that much easier tonight. There are some positive things to say. And one of the first things we have to recognize is that in the New Testament, when you open it up and you look at the churches that are described there, quite a number of those churches met in houses. So, for example, we pointed out that in Romans, the 16th chapter, verses 3 and 5, some of Paul's greetings at the end, a lot of what we know about these churches just come from some quick greetings. He mentions the fact that they needed to greet Priscilla and Aquila and likewise the church that is in their house. And so you keep on reading in your New Testament in the Colossian letter, in chapter 4 and verse 15, it talks about in the city of Laodicea that there was a church meeting in the household of Nymphas. In Philemon, the second verse, and I think this is reference to the church in Colossae, because I think Philemon was a member there, it says to them and the greetings to the beloved Apia, Archippus, our fellow soldier, and to the church in your house. And so there was a church meeting in their house. Finally, another verse that we mentioned was in 1 Corinthians, the 16th chapter and verse 19. Another reference to Aquila and Priscilla, who at the time of this letter were living in a different place. But Paul says that the churches of Asia greet you. Aquila and Priscilla greet you heartily in the Lord with the church that is in their house. And so if you went to the New Testament and you looked at the pattern there, you'll see there's nothing inappropriate at all in a church deciding to meet in a house. That's not the issue. And a little bit later on, we'll describe three characteristics, as we did last week, of what kind of is indicative of those that are in house churches today and in turn are critical of what we are doing here. But on just very surface, nothing wrong with having a church in a house. In fact, those that have done this in many cases have done so because they've raised a number of important questions. And I would say, by the way, I didn't say this last week, but I want to emphasize, a lot of these questions, it's not like these are brand new questions. It's not like that suddenly somebody decided that, well, here's a question that we just haven't been thinking about as a church in a long time. I think that we have. Maybe not always with the emphasis that they needed, but certainly these are questions that should have concerned us all the way through. Questions like, how can we achieve and maintain meaningful worship and avoid our worship becoming just an empty ritual, a habit where every Sunday morning we gather as a church here and you can pretty much count on how things are going to be done, and you just come and you just sort of watch it happening, and it just seems to be a very empty thing. It doesn't touch us, nor does it honor and glorify God in the way that it should. That's an important question. We ought to always be thinking about our worship in that sense. Not only that, there's this question that's been raised, how can we avoid having a passive spectator kind of mentality when we're here? And I think you know what I mean. There's a temptation even right now. We've got an audience, if you will, listening to this lesson. Are we coming in a very passive way so that everything in our worship is just sort of us sitting there and watching something happening? Or participating in a very light way, but not completely with a heart. So it's almost like we're a spectator there to see something happening. And I'll quote something to you a little bit later on that'll make this even clearer. Now, I'll tell you, this is a question I know has been dealt with in this church for a number of years. We've talked about this a lot. Let's make sure that we know that we're not here as an audience. We are here to worship God. Every single individual needs to be focused on God and not in just some passive way. We'll have more to say about that again later in the lesson. And then the third question, a good one, how can we make the Lord's Supper a more meaningful thing, a more central part of our worship? I think it's correct to point out in the New Testament that churches, when they gathered on the Lord's Day, had the Lord's Supper as a central focus of what they were doing. They were remembering the Lord's death. And if we gather on Sunday morning and we fail to put the right emphasis to the Lord's Supper that we should, well, then we're failing to be a church like they were in the New Testament. And so it's a good question to at least ask. Are we putting the focus there as we ought to? And these questions have been raised by many of those in this movement, if you will. And oftentimes the problems associated with trying to answer these questions seem so profound And so tied together with the idea of size. Think about it, in every one of these cases, the bigger you are, maybe the easier it is to fall on these questions in a way in which you're not having meaningful worship. It becomes more passive. The Lord's Supper is more of a rush-through kind of thing. If that's the case, if those numbers kind of exacerbate the problem, if you will, then a number of people looked at it and said, you know, this just doesn't work. And so they've taken a very different tact and have broken up even churches, or recommended rather, that you would break up a church of this size into maybe 20 or 30 churches and have each church meeting in an individual's home. But it wouldn't be that the one church would be breaking up into some pieces and doing different activity. It would literally be that we might reconstitute ourselves into 20 or 25 different churches, feeling that's the only way that we're ever really going to address questions like this. That's a serious challenge. And if we believe that what we're doing is correct here as a congregation with this many members in a place like this, then we need to have addressed these questions and know that we can meet the way that we are and yet still overcome these things. In fact, what I think is the case is that these are good questions. But to think that you have to break up into small house churches, and that's the only way in which you're going to please the Lord and solve these kinds of questions, that's the wrong answer to some very good questions and some very good concerns. It's looking to something new and exciting and different, but it's the wrong answer if we think that's the only way in which we can please the Lord. And so we looked at house churches last week, and we said, you know, there's three things that would characterize them in a general way. Now, I talked to a number of you later. It's interesting, and those who had a little more experience with some of these kinds of churches, that some would say, you know, they're actually doing this practice that other churches aren't doing. And so this isn't going to be indicative of every single house church. But in general, the emphasis is this. And all of these points, by the way, are clearly emphasized by Lagarde Smith in his book. One is that a house church arrangement is the only sound New Testament pattern for churches. This is the way that it ought to be. And what you oftentimes find is when you're reading some of this literature, this point is made. If you're going to solve these problems, if you're going to answer these questions, you're really going to have meaningful worship, you've got to do it in the form of meeting in a house. That's what's going to solve this problem. A lot of times at the end, it kind of softens just a little bit. Because you think about it for a moment, if a house church becomes very successful in gaining new members, eventually they sort of outstrip the size of the house. Well, then what do you do? There's some interesting questions that come along there. And they begin to sort of back off just a little bit from it. So, well, Lagarde, for example, says, maybe if you get as large as 150, that would be okay. I don't know where that number comes from, but the idea is still, size is a problem. You don't want to get too large. But the emphasis is, this is the way you ought to do it. Not just our need is we have to meet in a church at the in a house at the moment. This is what you ought to do. But the second characteristic, and this is very important, is the idea that somehow or another the Lord's Supper is to be kept in conjunction with a common meal. Now there's a practice that we don't do here at all. When we partook of the Lord's Supper this morning, we broke the bread and we drank of the cup. We did not eat a common fellowship kind of meal in association with the Lord's Supper. And what many are saying in this movement is, you need to do that because that's what the church did in the New Testament. And if you're not eating a meal like that, you're not really keeping the Lord's Supper as the church did then, nor are you practicing things the way that the church did in the New Testament. And finally, there's this emphasis on worship as being informal, as being spontaneous, as being something that everybody needs to participate in. And we'll come back to this point in a minute, but I should clarify. I think we have mutual participation here. But really what they're saying is that each individual needs to specifically do something. Each person needs to read a passage or lead a prayer or start a song. And some would distinguish, by the way, that only the men ought to do that. But there are a number of these house churches where it doesn't matter whether you're a man or a woman. Everybody sitting around in a circle having had the common meal and partaking of the Lord's Supper is then expected or allowed to somehow start a song, give a little talk, express a thought, lead a prayer, something along that line. And of course, there'd be some issues with women doing it. But even this idea that every single man has to do that or would be expected to do that, well, that's different, isn't it, than the way that we conducted our worship even tonight. Last week, we addressed this first issue, and so I'm not going to beat it to death again. The idea that you have to meet in a house to somehow or another be pleasing to God as a church runs against what the Scriptures really tell us about what churches were doing in the New Testament. For example, the church in Jerusalem, we went there and we went through a number of passages to recognize that there was one church in the city of Jerusalem, and it was composed of thousands of members. And that not only were they worshiping together, but there were times when they were all physically in the same place. I'll remind you of Acts chapter 6 in verse 2 when the apostles wanted to address the entire church and talk to them about the issue of how their widows were being treated. It says the multitude of them They gathered the multitude of them in one place and talked to them. And so there, certainly, you didn't have a church meeting in a house. It was far too large to do. It appears that they were meeting in the temple on a regular basis where there was room to accommodate thousands of them, partaking of the Lord's Supper. Now, how they did that exactly, I don't know. I doubt seriously they had one cup that they would have passed all the way through, thousands of them. But whatever they did, it worked for them, though they were thousands in a different place than a house. We also mentioned Acts chapter 19, verses 9 and 10, where in the city of Ephesus, for a period of time, Paul was meeting in the synagogue and gathering up some disciples, but when that no longer was feasible because of their attitude and such, it talks about him withdrawing or taking the disciples with him, and they met, he taught, in the school of Tyrannus for over a year, as it describes in verse 9 and 10 of Acts chapter 19. I think the point is, in regard to this first point, is that it doesn't matter where a church meets. There's no one place that we're told in the Scriptures where we need to do it. It depends on the group, does it not? Depends on the needs of the group. How would you address a church of the size of this? Where would be a good place to meet? That ought to be more of our question. What would allow us to do what God expects of a church if we are this size? That determines where we meet. Not that it has to be in a house or in a temple or in a school. That's just an expedient toward truly worshiping God the way that He's asked us to do. So let's get to the second point that we talked about a little bit, at least last Sunday night. What about the idea that the Lord's Supper needs to be kept in conjunction with some type of a fellowship meal? And I want you to picture how that might work within a house church. You all get together. There's 15 or 20 maybe or so at the most. You're able to sit somehow together, maybe in a circle of some kind. You share a meal. And you know what that's like when you share a meal. Conversation flows a lot better. You're more relaxed. There's this fellowship with one another. And so there's a lot of emphasis on all the good that comes from sitting around and eating in that fashion. And then at the end of that, you're able to take of bread and break it and partake of the Lord's Supper and drink of the fruit of the vine. And it's connected together with this fellowship meal. And it's just more meaningful if you do it, but it's something that you really ought to do. Does the New Testament teach that? Does it tell us that it's permissible or even required that we have some type of fellowship meal? I challenged you last week because there is a passage, or two rather, that are used to try to establish the fact that you ought to have a meal such as this. And the first of these I ask you to read is 1 Corinthians 11th chapter. I wanted you really to read from verse 17 all the way to verse 34. Now, as I expected afterwards, a few folks came up and said, I don't understand. Why would I be reading that in regard to support for having a meal along with the Lord's Supper? Because every time I've ever read that, it says, don't do that. Well, that's the way I read it as well. And I've tried. I've tried several times over the last year or so since I've read some of these things to read into verses 17 to 34 the idea that you should, you need to, you must have some type of meal, common meal, along with the Lord's Supper. Because I think that's exactly what Paul is saying, don't do. I want you to look here in chapter 11 and note, first of all, that the whole church was coming together. Verse 18 talks about this. First of all, when you come together as a church. And down in verse 21, it appears that what was happening in Corinth was they were eating a meal. They were doing this very thing. They were having a meal along with the Lord's Supper. He says, for in eating, each one takes his own supper ahead of others. One is hungry and another is drunk. They were having some type of common meal alongside of the Lord's Supper. The question is, how did Paul feel about that? And what you notice in verses 20 to 22 is that he appears to be severely rebuking them because they were doing this. Well, let's read verse 20 to 22 together. Paul says to them, therefore, when you come together in one place, it is not to eat the Lord's Supper. For in eating, each one takes his own supper ahead of others. One is hungry, another is drunk. What? Do you not have houses to eat and drink in? Or do you despise the church of God and shame those who have nothing? What shall I say to you? Shall I praise you in this? I do not praise you. Now, reading that, and Paul is not pleased at all that they are doing this. That in fact, what is happening, because they are eating this meal along with the Lord's Supper, they have distracted from the Lord's Supper. They're no longer even partaking of the Lord's Supper in a way that would be pleasing to God. It's not working this way. It's what it seems to me that Paul is saying. Now, some have tried to read into this passage. The idea would be that what's saying is that the meal was okay. In fact, they should have been doing that. But the emphasis is on the divisiveness that's happening there in Corinth. Now, that's clearly happening. They were having great issues in not being united. And so that is part of what Paul is correcting them. Their selfishness as well. And so the idea somehow is that a meal's required, but they just weren't doing it right. But you know, if you read the entire part, verse 17 to 34, it's hard to come away with the impression that all he's doing is saying, y'all stop being so divisive and get that meal right that you're supposed to be eating along with the Lord's Supper. That doesn't seem to be the message at all. In fact, in verse 34, when he finally just kind of concludes all of his thoughts here about the Lord's Supper and what they were doing, what does he say to them? He says, if anyone is hungry, let him eat at home, lest one, you come together for judgment, and the rest I will set in order when I come. Even his last words seem to indicate you're not doing what you should be doing. Don't have this meal and link it somehow with the Lord's Supper. One other thought on that as well. Look at the emphasis that Paul does give in verses 23 to 26 of this chapter. Because in describing to them some of the things that they were doing wrong surrounding the Lord's Supper, he also talks to them about how it is that they ought to be partaking of it. How was it supposed to work? And he reminds them of the way that Jesus established the Lord's Supper in the first place. In fact, he starts with verse 23. I received from the Lord. Okay. Here is some instruction about how the Lord's Supper really ought to work. And it would be interesting if in these verses, as he talks about what he received from the Lord, he says, this is how you ought to eat the meal, and then this is how you ought to partake of the Lord's Supper. That's not the emphasis. Instead, what he talks about in verse 23 to 26 is this. He says what he received from the Lord was that the Lord Jesus, on the same night in which he was betrayed, he took bread. And when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, Take, eat, this is my body which is broken for you. Do this in remembrance of me. In the same manner, he also took the cup after supper, saying, this cup is the new covenant in my blood. This do as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. For as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death till he comes. It's really a very simple thing. And by the way, he did this after they had eaten a meal. We don't want to obscure that fact. They had eaten the Passover meal. But we're not commanded anywhere to partake of the Passover meal. When the meal was over, Jesus then turned and instituted the Lord's Supper. And what he did was, he broke the bread and gave it to them and told them to do that in like manner in remembrance of him. The same thing with the cup, to drink of the cup and to use that to remember him. And so Paul makes it very clear, as long as you do that, as often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death till he comes. That's not that complicated. That's what we're being asked to do, to remember the Lord. And we've had a lesson on this not too long ago at all about the Lord's Supper. We're not given a lot of details about how to pass it around or the size of the bread or the kind of container to do with the cup. Those things aren't given to us, but what is when we partake of it, we are supposed to remember the Lord's death. And if we're not doing that, the failure is not in the form of how we're doing this. The failure is in our heart. And I want you to remember that when we come back to mutual participation and think about that. I think that's really the failure. But what else? Surely there's another passage or two along this line. Turn over to the book of Jude, the 12th chapter of Jude. And in Jude 12, there's a warning given, a very stout warning, about some that might teach them falsely. Here in Jude, verse 12, it says, there are spots in your love feast. While they feast with you without fear, serving only themselves, they are clouds without water. carried about by the winds, late summer tree, autumn trees without fruit, twice dead, pulled up by the roots, and goes on to keep describing these individuals. You notice that phrase, though, your love feast. Now, what were they? The thought is that the love feast were this meal, this fellowship meal that was eaten along with the Lord's Supper. Is that the case? You can't tell from this passage that it was. Now, you can find some commentaries that will say that's what it was. But we don't know. We really have no idea that that's what was done because this verse just mentions a love feast. It could be that the love feast was the Lord's Supper. Could it not? Isn't the Lord's Supper a feast done in love, in remembrance of the Lord? As we break the bread this morning and we drink the cup, that could be the love feast. It could be that the love feast was just simply a reference to the times that they were together as Christians in hospitality, enjoying one another's company. We are supposed to be doing that, by the way. We need to emphasize, perhaps more than we do, the need for hospitality and being in one another's homes. And those occasions, those may be the love feasts that are described. It could be that just metaphorically, love feast is being used to describe the fellowship that Christians have with one another in a broader sense. The fellowship that we all have with one another in the Lord. Now, the fact that we don't know what a love feast is does not take away from this passage. Read it again. The passage is not about the love feast. The passage is about false teachers who are among Christians and who are acting in a worldly and selfish manner, who really don't care so much about the Lord as much as they care about themselves. And he's saying, be careful when you have people like that among you. I don't have to know exactly what the love feasts were. What I do need to be careful about is associating with individuals who through their selfishness and their false teaching influence me to pull me away from the Lord. That's what this passage is about. But here's the main point. If our goal is to serve the Lord according to how He has instructed us, are you comfortable eating a common meal in association with the Lord's Supper? Can you gain enough understanding out of 1 Corinthians 11 and out of Jude 12 to feel like that's what the Lord wants you to do? Would you stand before the Lord in judgment and feel comfortable? I know this pleases the Lord. This is what He wants me to do. I can't get there. I don't see that. In fact, I see the very opposite, that I need to be careful about doing anything like that and instead avoid a common meal and put our attention and focus upon the Lord's death as we break the bread and as we drink of the cup each first day of the week. But then there's this last point, this last characteristic that a number of these churches that would describe, a great number of them, and that is that oftentimes they will say, they'll claim, that worship that's planned and organized is really worship that's not going to do what the Lord expects of us. In fact, it's inconsistent with the pattern that you find in the New Testament when you look at worship. And I want you to think how attention-grabbing that statement ought to be to those of us whose goal is to please the Lord and to follow what the New Testament says. If somebody claims that worship that's planned out and organized is not keeping the pattern that you can find in the New Testament, and our goal is to keep that, well, we better really stop and think for a moment, because I think we're going to agree in just a little bit that our worship is kind of planned out. In fact, there's really two parts to this. There's kind of two arguments or two statements. Argument may be a little bit hard of a word to use there. The first one is the claim that the New Testament worship was informal and spontaneous. That is, when Christians got together and they worshiped God, that their worship was a very informal kind of thing. They didn't necessarily know when they got there how many songs or who was going to lead it or what kind of lesson would be taught. In fact, it was more of just a spontaneous thing. When somebody had a song, they just burst out in song. When somebody else wanted to lead a prayer, they just started leading the prayer. And without the kind of formality that we often have in our worship, they were able to please the Lord because that's what was expected, this informality, this spontaneity. Not only that, but the idea that the New Testament worship then involved mutual participation. I alluded to that earlier. Not that we're all focused on the same song, singing one song, but rather that every single person is somehow or another going to start something out. One person will have a song, another will have a prayer, another will have a reading, someone will have a short talk, but everybody's going to do something. There's going to be that type of mutual participation in that. Now, in regard to something, go back to this first point for a moment, the idea of the worship being informal and spontaneous. Think about how different that is than what you, if you were here this morning, or considering the worship tonight, how different that is. Now, we had a duty roster. You can go out in the back and look, and on the board it'll tell you, I was about to say it's going to tell you who's going to lead singing next Sunday, but I think that takes us into August. We've got to have August duty roster, Bill. We've got to get that up. But if you go through this month, you can look and you can see who's going to lead the singing. Who's going to do the reading? What are we going to read? There's a list back there that will tell you that we're going to read this passage on Sunday night. A song leader. Who's going to lead the singing? Now, we don't know the songs, but we generally know the order. But when the song leader arrives, he knows how many songs he's going to lead. He knows which songs he's going to lead. Sometimes he even themes those songs together and knows what's going to be done. I would imagine most of us know here who worship long enough the likely pattern of our worship in the morning, that following a song, the men are going to come up, we're going to do the offering, and then immediately after that we're going to have a song about the Lord's Supper, and then we're going to partake of the Lord's Supper. There's some organization, there's something about that that's sort of expected. And what they're saying is, that's not the way you need to do it. It needs to be informal, and it needs to be spontaneous. Both of these arguments, by the way, are heavily used. I'll ask you to turn in your Bibles. 1 Corinthians chapter 14. Verse 26. Now, you might as well just go ahead and park yourself a little bit in 1 Corinthians 14. We're going to use this in a moment to go through a number of verses there. But listen to what verse 26 says, 1 Corinthians 14. It says here, "How is it then, brethren, whenever you come together, each of you has a psalm, has a teaching, has a tongue, has a revelation, has an interpretation, let all things be done for edification." Well, let's look at these two arguments for a moment. Let's look at this first one and think about it in light of what 1 Corinthians 14 says. I think it'll help our understanding of this a great deal as well. Here's the way one of the claims that this group, those who are part of it, would say. Here's a quote. "The primitive church in the New Testament, first century church, had an intimacy, informality, and a degree of mutual participation largely foreign to our own experience." It was different. We're not doing it the way that they did it. Well, is that the case? I mean, when you open up 1 Corinthians 14, here's an examination of how worship ought to be done. It's in the context of how to use spiritual gifts. And we don't have miraculous gifts today. But nevertheless, there's a great deal in the explanation in 1 Corinthians 14 about how they were to handle these miraculous gifts and how they were to conduct their worship that ought to be useful to us as we also worship. Because it talks about singing, it talks about prayer, it talks about a number of things. It ought to be useful to us. And I want you to just listen to a few of the verses here and think about whether or not there's any kind of order that's being imposed in these verses. Or were they to just do everything in a completely spontaneous way where it didn't matter when anything got done? Or is Paul actually trying to impose some degree of organization and order to the worship that they had? So, for example, let's begin with verse 23. In verse 23, it says, "Therefore, if the whole church comes together in one place and all speak with tongues, and there come in one those who are uninformed or unbelievers, will they not say that you are out of your mind?" The idea here is that it would be possible for them and their worship to do it in such a way that there's a degree of chaos about it, that somebody walks in and is disturbed by it and is turned away from Christ. Now, he's talking again about spiritual gifts, but if you could just do anything you wanted, you could just be as spontaneous as possible, just one person after another without any control. Is it possible that this might happen, what he's described here? Look at verse 26. This is the verse that's often quoted in this, but I want you to notice the last part of verse 26. He says, "Let all things be done for edification." whatever the other part of verse 26 is talking about, it's saying do this in a way that in the end, what you have accomplished is edification. Now, I would argue that oftentimes when you just let anybody speak at any moment, and it's just spontaneous, you don't know who's going to say it or what they're going to talk about or how it's going to be connected to the last person and what they said, that's not necessarily going to lead for edification. In fact, one of the interesting quotes out of Lagarde's book is he points out, you know, this is kind of a weakness here, the fact that you just don't know what's going to come out from anybody, but we really need to do this anyway. It's sort of the point that's made. But if all things are done for edification, does that say that perhaps some degree of order and organization might be useful in that? How about, let's just read verse 26 through 33. Listen carefully and think about whether any kind of order is being suggested here and how they did their worship. Beginning with verse 26. Well, we'll begin with verse 27. We've already looked at verse 26 a couple of times. Here Paul says, if anyone speaks in a tongue, let there be two or at the most three, each in turn, and let one interpret. But if there's no interpreter, let them keep silent in church and let him speak to himself and to God. Let two or three prophets speak and let the others judge. But if anything is revealed to another who sits by, let the first keep silent. For you can all prophesy one by one that all may learn and all may be encouraged. And the spirits of the prophet are subject to the prophets. For God is not the author of confusion but of peace, as in all the churches of the saints. He's regulating this. He's saying when you come together, do it in this manner. But there seems to be some limit about who's going to do it and when they're going to do it. Not quite that vision of just complete spontaneity that you might otherwise think of. Finally, verse 40 in this chapter, he says, let all things be done decently and in order. And to whatever degree it's informal or spontaneous, it still needs to be done decently and in order. And so there is some degree of order or organization, it seems to me, imposed here. But think about other places that you read about in your New Testament when the church was together. In Acts chapter 20 and verse 7, when they came together and they broke bread, what else happened on that day? Paul preached till midnight. It wasn't a case where every single person had to do something. Here's one person teaching them, apparently for a lot longer than I'm going to teach tonight. And they all listened and participated in that. In Acts chapter 13, there's a good example of the words of one of Paul's sermons. And you'll see there's structure to the sermon that he gave in Antioch and Pisidia. Not only that, but the apostles. We're told in Acts chapter 2 and verse 42 that the church there was being instructed in their doctrine. So the apostles were teaching them. In fact, we learn later they were teaching from in public places and in house to house, but there was this idea of listening carefully to them, not necessarily the degree of spontaneity that you see in a place like this. The main thing is, if our goal is edification, if that's really what God is telling us, would it not be appropriate to have some forethought as to how we're going to go about our worship? That a song leader would think through a number of songs in advance, maybe even theme them together, and maybe connect it somehow with the lesson to some degree. Is that degree of formality in that, is that leading us away from meaningful worship? Or does that somehow help to edify us, help to honor God, that we put that kind of thought into it in advance? Now, you can go to an extreme on one side of this or the other. I recognize that. We can make our worship so rigid in the pattern, so formal, and we do it just exactly the same every single Sunday morning to the point that nobody pays any attention to it. But to say that you should have no organization behind it at all seems to me to go completely against the idea of it being edified. What about this second point then, the idea of mutual participation? I think I understand why the idea of every person taking some part is emphasized and seen as such a positive thing. It is very possible for us to fall into the pattern of just sitting out there comfortably and letting the emblems of the Lord's Supper pass by without thinking about them, to just almost listen to the songs rather than really sing them from the heart, to kind of listen on as somebody drones on and preaches longer than they ought to. We're not really connecting to that lesson and thinking it through, you know what? If every one of us needed to be ready with a prayer, with a song, with something, maybe that would keep our attention better. I understand why there's some degree of emphasis on this idea of mutual participation. But someone said it this way. He says, you know, even though there's all this emphasis on the acts of worship that the church has, he put it this way, yet it seems as if we never once stop to realize that those acts of worship as practiced among us today are mostly an orchestrated religious spectacle for which we have reserved seats each week. Is that true? Is that what's happening when we come together as the church here, the Church of Christ that meets here at Embry Hills? Is this just an orchestrated religious spectacle for which we have reserved seats? Now, I couldn't help but chuckle over part of that. I have trouble finding a seat sometimes. I don't think we have reserved seats, but I understand what they're saying. Is that what's happening with us? Because if it is, then shame on us. The answer is not to conclude that 1 Corinthians 14 and verse 26 tells us that every single person that's here needs to start a song, start a prayer, have a psalm, or whatever. First of all, if you take 1 Corinthians 14, verses 34 and 35 seriously, then the women are not supposed to do that. And so when it says each one should have a psalm, it's not talking about the women. It's not saying literally every single person needs to do this. And we shouldn't conclude that. In fact, I think here's the problem. We have the wrong idea on what mutual participation really is. Maybe we have the wrong idea about what worship is. I think the issue, if there is one, is with individuals. It's not necessarily with churches. And so I want you to just think for a moment. When we're teaching, as I'm trying now, are you engaged? Are you listening carefully to what's being said? And I was thinking about how there's this pattern in the New Testament of the apostles teaching and expecting people to listen and to learn. Of course, your point ought to be, well, you know what? You're not an apostle. That's exactly right. That's why you need to be listening more carefully to me than perhaps even they listened to Paul. They knew what Paul said was the truth. You need to have your scriptures open and looking and seeing if the men who speak from here are really teaching what is the truth. That's an active thing that we're doing. And we need to be thinking about, how does this apply to me? How could this change my life? What should I be doing as I'm listening to these things? What about our singing? In Colossians, the third chapter in verse 16, it says that we are teaching and admonishing one another. How do you get more mutually participative than that if we are teaching one another as we're singing? Do we think about it that way? Is that what we have visioned as we are singing songs? Or do we feel like we're just sort of following the leader? You know, somebody's waving their arms and we're just kind of following. Are we really singing from the heart, knowing what we're saying, understanding the words, and trying to encourage one another as we're singing and trying to praise our Lord in heaven as we're doing so? That's a mutual thing that we're doing together as a church. Prayer. Does everybody have to lead a prayer in order for us to truly pray to God? Or can somebody lead the prayer and we make it our own? Now, it's a pattern. You see men leading prayers often in the scriptures. Do we have the ability to listen, to put our own thoughts into that same prayer, to recognize that it's going before God, and to put the meaning into the prayer as someone else is leading, as John did this morning? Are we able to do that? That's important that be a mutual thing. And the Lord's Supper. The Lord's Supper is something that we all do. In fact, in 1 Corinthians 10, and I meant to write this down, verse 16 and 17, it says that this cup of blessing which we bless, is it not the communion of the blood of Christ? The bread which we break, is it not a communion of the body of Christ? And we, though many, are one bread and one body, for we all partake of that one bread. That's mutual participation. We're all together in one place with our minds and hearts focused on God, and we're all partaking of this in communion with one another and with our God and our Lord Jesus Christ. And when we do that as individuals, then I think we are truly fulfilling what the Lord wants us to do. I think the failure is sometimes we don't recognize that the church is a family.
and that we're all working together as a family. And sometimes, even in these kinds of circumstances, you need a leader to help us as a family to participate in the way that we should, but we're still a family. And it's a lot bigger question than what we do in worship. Because, you know, if you don't get this, if you don't understand that we're mutually participating when we come together to worship, how would we get the picture that we are mutually participating in our effort as a church for all of us to have our souls saved? That we're working together as a family to encourage and to build one another up outside of the walls of this building in our lives all through the week. And we're coming to know one another and participate in each other's lives so that together we can be an encouragement and a source of edification and a source of truth for the rest of the world to see so that they too can come to know Christ. That's the participation, I think, that the Lord really wants us to have. Again, I've gone right to 7 o'clock. I tried so hard to do this. But let me just say, all of these two lessons, this hasn't been a defense of the status quo. I don't necessarily think that everything we do here is just the absolute best way that you can do it. I do think this, though, maybe this is an important point to remind us. I think that we have restored New Testament worship. And I think we are doing the things that you can find that the church did in the New Testament. If I didn't believe that, then I would want to change. And I would like somebody to show us if we're not following and doing what they did in the New Testament. But could we do it better? Can we do it in a more edifying way? We may follow the form that's taught in the New Testament. I think that we do. But can we do it in a way that builds us up more? We should always be looking for ways to do that. And we need to be open to change if it's within the parameters permitted by the Scriptures. And not feel like it's got to be the way that it always was done. But when we change something, it needs to be scriptural, and it needs to be out of the right motive. Not just because we want to do it, just to be doing something different or times have changed. It needs to be done because we truly think it will build us up more and spread the gospel better to others. Y'all have listened so patiently through these two lessons. I appreciate that. I want to remind you of what I concluded with last week, and that is the most important restoration of all. And sometimes it truly is a radical restoration. It's when an individual knows that he's not living in a way that's pleasing to God. If you know that you're not, and you know that you need to respond to Christ for the first time in confession that He is the Christ, repenting of your sins and being willing to be baptized so those sins are washed away, or you're a child of God needing to do something else to be brought back into a restored relationship with God, please come forward as we stand and as we sing.